Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're going to talk with Tim McGrath, author of the new book, Three Roads to Gettysburg, Meade, Lee, Lincoln, and the Battle That Changed the War, the Speech That Changed the Nation. These three men came from different parts of the country, very different upbringings. Robert E. Lee, son of the aristocratic and slaveholding South. George Gordon Meade, raised in the industrious straight-laced North. Abraham Lincoln, from the rowdy, untamed West. Lincoln's election to the presidency in 1860 split the country in two and triggered the Civil War, and Lee and Meade found themselves on opposite sides while Lincoln had the Sisyphean task of reuniting the country. Tim McGrath is a winner of the Samuel Eliot Morrison Award for Naval Literature, two-time winner of the Commodore John Barry Book Award, as well as the author of the critically acclaimed biographies James Monroe, A Life, and John Barry, An American Hero in the Age of Sail. Tim McGrath, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Mr. Williams. It's a privilege to be with you. How's life in Utah this morning?
Beautiful. Nice fall day. Yeah. We've had some kind of warmer temperatures. So, yeah. Now, where are you speaking to us from?
Outside of Philadelphia, where it's a typical November.
All right.
Which rivals only February as the longest months of the year.
Okay. Well, good to have you on today. I guess the first question, what drew you to this subject for your new book?
Well, that's a good start, Mr. Williams. My agent, Jim Donovan, who's an excellent author in his own right, and my editor at the time, Brent Howard, had suggested a book on George Gordon Meade, and I was intrigued and looked into it. I found out that a wonderful history professor, Dr. Jennifer Murray, has been at work for quite some time on a biography of Meade. She's a terrific lady and a wonderful writer. So tuck that one away for a presentation with Access Utah. It will be the definitive biography of Meade. But then we talked about something around that. And I said, well, I was always intrigued by the decisions that were made, not just by Meade, but by Lee and also Lincoln. And then to go back into seeing how did they get here and getting into a story of their lives and what happened. They're not definitive biographies by the size of the book, as you can tell, nor is it a minute by minute account of the Battle of Gettysburg, but it is sort of how did they get there and what did they do?
So Meade is the one I'm less familiar with, probably a lot of listeners as well. Maybe we could start with him. So you have North, South, and West, right, in these three men?
Yes. Yeah.
So Meade, one thing I learned, a lighthouse builder. That's fascinating. I've never even heard of that. You see lighthouses, I guess they have to be built, right? But tell me about a little bit about George Meade.
Sure. He is the son of Richard Worsam Meade, who was part of a successful Philadelphia mercantile family. But he's the wunderkind of the family. By the time Meade is born, he's born in Cadiz in Spain because Meade has moved there because of all of his dealings with there. He's the representative for the U.S. Navy. By the time of Meade's birth, he's amassed a fortune of $500,000, which is relatively a billionaire today, and a library so expansive and vast that people compared it to Jefferson's, and Meade made sure that Jefferson knew that. He was quite arrogant. He lends his money to the Spanish government during the Napoleonic War, and when the war is said and done, there's been a change in government, he tries to get his money back, and he does not succeed at all, and comes home still fighting with Congress to see what they can do on his behalf. He dies 2 years before his 50th birthday, when Meade is about 12 years old, and the whole thing has upset the family economically. The widow, Margaret Meade, is doing what she can by selling off his artwork and things, but Meade is interested as a young boy of becoming a lawyer, but she can't afford to send him to like the University of Pennsylvania or someplace like that. The only education she can find for him is West Point because it's free. So he shifts from a law pursuit to a military one, but what he really falls in love with is engineering. And he does well, graduates 19th in his class, but He comes out determined that he'll do his 1 year service time. That was the requirement back then. And then go into civilian life and become an engineer.
So I guess that's how does he get into a lighthouse building? Is that a kind of a direct path?
Yeah, well, it's a, there's a family connection with that. He does a stint in the Army through 1836 into 37 in Florida and in Arkansas. He then does resign, and he gets a couple of jobs with engineering with a railroad, new railroad company that fails with the Panic of 1837, and a couple of other assignments. But he realizes that if he wants steady work, he's going to have to re-enlist, which he does. Now, there's family members that have also gone into to West Point and in the Navy. He has a brother who was one of the naval lieutenants who whose boarding party comes aboard the L'Amistad, and he's one of the lieutenants that sues for salvage and loses. But Meade's relations helped get him his first start on a lighthouse in the middle of the Delaware Bay. There's been a rebuilt one there from 1914, but the structure's the same. And he becomes a very, very innovative designer and builder and almost inventor for lighthouses that stretch from New Jersey down to the Florida Keys.
Tell me a little bit about this. I was fascinated by this process. I don't want to take the whole discussion. We could. I could divert this over to nothing but lighthouse building, but I won't. But there's a scene in he's in the Florida Keys. He's been assigned to build a lighthouse on an island that disappears during hurricanes, right? In fact, the lighthouse keeper says this is pretty dangerous. People might disappear out here. Unfortunately, that lighthouse keeper and his family disappeared in a subsequent hurricane. Tell me about building lighthouses.
Well, he came up, there was a Irishman who came upon an idea of securing them much better by taking screws that were 20, 30 feet long and putting them like this into the ground beneath the body of water. A fellow named Alexander Mitchell, and the miracle of his discovery is that Mitchell is blind, but he comes up with this very innovative idea they call screw pile technology. And Meade uses it at Brandy Rhine Shoals in the Delaware. And as he goes down, he's assigned to the district, Southeast District, and he looks there and he says, a brick and mortar lighthouse won't survive here. We have to build a metal skeleton. And again, using that kind of technology, he finds the best spot on this little key. It's barely above sea level and low tide. And erects that, puts the, you know, tower up. There's housing for the lighthouse keeper and his family. And two or three hurricanes wipe out everything but the lighthouse. And the lighthouse keeper is saved because he's at the top in the tower. And while Meade's lighthouses aren't really in any use today, so many of them still stand. And I think that's a tribute to his engineering. In one of the ones in New Jersey, he looks at the site where they're starting to build it and he goes, it's going to wash away. The ground isn't strong enough there. We've got to find better ground, higher ground. So his lighthouses at Barnegat, at Absecon outside of New Jersey, and in Cape May, they're beautiful. When you get to be 74, they're a bit challenged to walk up to the top. But if you want to know where Meade learned the value of high ground, it's building lighthouses.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that'll come into Gettysburg, obviously. He had a one more thing on this. He had an innovative design. I guess they called it the Meade design for the actual light and how the oil would feed the flame.
Yeah, he was constantly looking at what would be better and more efficient. And he comes up with a system with Fresnel lighting as to how to get the oil into the lamp. And it's so far ahead of its time that he's invited to go to this New York Symposium on Science and describe his light and bring one with him to show. And he's excited as all get out. You start to read about Meade in any Civil War book, and the first quote you hear is that he was called a the sort of angry, bespectacled, snapping turtle. Nothing could be further from the truth. He's apparently quite a great storyteller. He's got a temper and he uses it, but he knows when to use it. And usually, and in tough times, hurricanes or battles, he's a pretty calm customer. But he is so excited about what he did with this. He went in the 1850s from a whole successful run of years of lighthouse building. And then they ask him to take over the Great Lakes Survey. And he comes with inventions to do that, how to accurately, survey the lakes and not just the distance between the shorelines, but what's the depth and what do the tides play into that? He's brilliant. And those 10 years, they're easily his happiest years in the military.
Let's go to the early years of Robert E. Lee. You have a chapter called The Lighthouse Builder, The Marble Model, and The Rail Splitter. So tell me about the Marble Model.
Lee's born, as most of your listeners, I'm sure, know. His father is Henry Lee III, who gets the nickname Light Horse Ca Harry for his successes as a cavalry officer during the Revolution. Washington thinks the world of him in terms of his courage and his tactics, but he's not too fond of his penchant for cruelty. But he still takes, he actually offers Lee a chance to be an aide of his, and he says, "No, my job is in the saddle." He's a Federalist, an oddity in Virginia, becomes the governor, but he also is a bit of a scalawag with money. He's the sort of uncle you have that you don't lend a quarter to. There's a story of where he asks another plantation owner if he can borrow a horse, and the fellow sends over the horse all tacked and ready for mounting and taken over by an enslaved man. 3 weeks later, the enslaved man comes back to the plantation, and the man says, "Where's my horse?" And he goes, "Well, Lee sold him." He goes, "Well, why didn't you come back?" He goes, "Because he sold me too." He winds up in debtor's prison. And then one of the things I did not know was right before the War of 1812, when all the politics, the Republicans are all for going to war, the Federalists are not. When he hears that a newspaper in Baltimore has been attacked, he and a few dozen Federalists go up there to defend it. And the ensuing melee, the Federalists are arrested. The mob the next day breaks in and they stab Light Horse Harry repeatedly with penknives and they pour hot candle wax into his eyes and disfigure him. He comes home, he leaves and goes to the Caribbean for several years. And he's on his way back when he dies in Georgia. And Lee is 11 years old then. And while his family is part of the Lees and the Carters, they don't, his mother has not much money at all. And she's also becoming an invalid. When he is accepted to West Point, she writes to her sister, "What will I do without Robert? He is both son and daughter to me. He was that caring." He graduates with no demerits. And he's only one of two cadets that did that. The problem with his graduating status is that the other fellow, a guy named Mason, is in his same graduating class and he has higher points per grade than Lee. So Lee graduates second. He goes into his military work. There are times when he's dissatisfied and talks openly to friends about resigning. He marries George Washington Custis's daughter. Custis is Martha Washington's grandson and the owner of the Arlington estate that we see where the cemetery is. That's another story. And Custis approves the wedding, but he doesn't trust Lee, especially where his money's concerned. A story I loved about Lee, speaking of engineering, in 1837, St. Louis is in danger of becoming dry docked. Something's happened with the way the current is flowing, and there's islands being formed, sandbars that are the size of islands, right in the Mississippi, in front of St. Louis, built of silt and sand and debris. They call one Blood Island because that's where the gentlemen go to fight their duels. That's the size of this thing. How are we going to get rid of it? And it falls to Lee. Congress doesn't give him near enough money that he wants, but he looks and decides that the problem is further north. He goes up to Iowa, to Des Moines Rapids and the rapids below, and he determines that that's the problem. And instead of building dams and dikes across to get things done, he comes up with an idea of literally blowing up little passageways in the rapids, in the rocks themselves, and then putting the dams or dikes running parallel to the Mississippi, not across it. And within weeks, St. Louis is back in business. He ticks off some Illinois speculators who've bought the land across from St. Louis, thinking, well, this is our moment to own a town. And I thought about the fact that historians and biographers talk about Abraham Lincoln's two trips down flatboats to New Orleans changed Lincoln when he saw the dro he'd seen enslaved persons. He'd lived around them before, but he never saw mass auctions and just the disparate cruelty and inhumanity that never left him. They'll say, Lincoln's trips changed the Mississippi. Lee's trip changed the Mississippi. So it's an interesting contrast.
Interesting, yeah. Tell me about Abraham Lincoln. What did you research? Okay, we know a lot about Lincoln, and or maybe we think we know a lot about Lincoln. What surprised you?
There's one thing early in his career, Mr. Williams, that really it was terrific. I'm no Lincoln scholar, would love to be, but I'm not. But it's impossible to start reading and getting the volumes of his writings, and you never want to leave. They're just that brilliant and wonderfully written. And you think about this person that's born in a log cabin and self-educated. He becomes not just a great trial lawyer, but a corporate lawyer. He represents the Illinois Central Railroad. But when he's elected to the legislature, there's talk of moving the Capitol from Vandalia to Springfield. He's 28 years old and part of a group the rest of the assemblymen call the Long Nine because they're all over 6 feet tall. Well, they turn to him, the youngest of the bunch, and say, take this by the horns and see what you can do to get the Capitol shifted. So he turns into a 28-year-old Lyndon Johnson. He's making deals back and forth to assembly. You want there's a the railroad will be coming in. You want it to come into your town. Well, we'll take care of that. Just vote for this measure. You would like a canal that would better serve your district. Well, we'll help and vote for building that. Just move this. An opponent of it says out loud in the minutes of the assembly, "Who is this uncouth scalawag that's doing all this stuff?" And he gets everything changed. Springfield became and still is the capital of Illinois.
By the way, you write, and we'll get to the Gettysburg Address, obviously, but you write, I'll pull it up here if I can here. You say he kind of a high-pitched voice, right?
Yes.
And Kentucky accent. We
Yes.
don't, and we don't, I don't know if we know what that sounds like today, right? But tell me
Now,
a little bit about that, how Lincoln would have been perceived by contemporaries.
when we see Lincoln portrayed, the two examples to me come up are Raymond Massey and Abe Lincoln in Illinois, which is a movie I still love. And Gregory Peck playing him in a miniseries in the 80s. So when they're delivering Lincoln speeches, there's this sonorous, deep, manly tone. Probably the best portrayal of it, if you wanted to get an idea, and it's back in the 70s, was Hal Holbrook's portrayal of, I think they called the miniseries Sandburg Lincoln. But he's way up here and by cracky, and look at what we got to do. And the thing that a couple of Lincoln experts have pointed out is that kind of voice carries. It's high pitched enough and strong enough that if he's speaking in a windstorm, you're going to hear him. And And I thought that was really an interesting thing to find out, because then when you start reading his writings, his letters, his speeches, that's the voice that comes into your head. It's not 47 years ago or with malice towards none. It's 47 years ago. And but it doesn't change the tone, and in a lot of ways it enhances it.
One thing that I learned from your book is that his grandfather was killed, right? Thomas's father, who was also Abraham, I think, was killed by Indians. This is, I wonder where I'm going with this. I wonder how people perceived, I think Easterners probably perceived the West as maybe still violent, kind of skepticism toward Westerners.
I don't know if I, you know, boy, Mr. Williams, I don't know, skepticism. I think that they would look at something like that as one of the hazards of heading west. And the fact that the Native Americans are fighting for the land that's been theirs for centuries. Lincoln is elected in New Salem. He's the captain of the local militia for the Black Hawk War. And they never serve in battle. But the regard that the New Salem residents had for him, he's 23 or 22 at the time, says a lot about him. But I think that the actions over the decades of the 19th century, where Native Americans are fighting the Seminole Wars in Florida that we rarely speak too much about, but certainly even into the Midwest during Lincoln's administration, there's quite a to-do with the Sioux Nation in Minnesota. So I think it could be perceived that way by Easterners, yeah.
Let's take a break and we'll come back with more with Tim McGrath. The book is Three Roads to Gettysburg, subtitled Meade, Lee, Lincoln, and the Battle That Changed the War and the Speech That Changed the Nation. More following this break. Thank you for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with Tim McGrath. He's author of the new book, Three Roads to Gettysburg, Meade, Lee, Lincoln, The Battle That Changed the War, The Speech That Changed the Nation. So, Tim McGrath, let's take these men to the Mexican-American War. Civil War, starts essentially with the Mexican-American War. So tell me briefly about each of these three men and how things changed with them. Trajectories changed, I think, with that war.
That's a good jumping off point, Mr. Williams. Meade is the first of the two officers to go to Mexico. He's under the command of General Zachary Taylor, Old Rough and Ready. And he's both an aide and an engineer, and pretty much does a good bit of scouting. He really comes to admire Taylor for his calmness. The fact that in the first battle of Palo Alto, he's struck by, Taylor's sitting on his horse, chewing tobacco, waiting to see how everything's going to go, and not move over here, get this thing done over there. And I think that sticks with him. He really admires Taylor's generalship and his personality. He serves bravely from Palo Alto through Monterey. He does his fair share of sound engineering and scouting reports, where to go, what to do, how to build a corduroy road when needed. Does more than his part. On his way back, he's runs into Winfield Scott's army, which has just landed, and a sizable group of portion of Taylor's army is being transferred over there, which Meade is furious about. He basically says, "You're leaving Taylor to get slaughtered," and yet Taylor has his great victory in Meade's absence at Buena Vista. While he's there, he meets an engineering captain that's come down with Scott, Robert E. Lee. Lee's story picks up where Meade's leaves off. Again, a very capable engineer, but Lee really shines in the Mexican War like no other soldier. In fact, Scott makes a point to tell everybody that. He's incredibly smart as a scout, There's one point where he wa finds himself encircled by a group of Mexican dragoons, and he's hiding behind a bush and a log until dark when he can leave. And his engineering skills come to the fore. He knows where to go and what to do. And then when the actual battle comes in, he takes part in it. Scott said he couldn't do without him, and really says he is the finest soldier in the army. Scott's campaign wins plaudits from military folks all over the world. The Duke of Wellington calls Scott the greatest general alive today. But Lee also comes out disenchanted. He makes a point of saying we should never have been down there in the first place. What we did was wrong. And that's a something I didn't know. Lincoln is elected to his only term in Congress when the Mexican War is being fought. He is the only Whig from Illinois in Congress. And he takes issue with Polk's declaration of war that American blood was shed on American soil. And a lot of people weren't sure that that was true. Lincoln jumps on it, and in one of his first speeches in Congress says, I would like the president to tell us the spot where this happened. And it doesn't go over too well. In fact, the only thing he gets out of it is the nickname Spotty Lincoln. But he learns a lot. One of the people he befriends is Alexander Stevens, who later becomes the vice president of the Confederacy, but at the time he's a Georgia Whig. Here's this short, very frail Georgian and this lanky, tall fellow from Illinois. And Stevens makes a speech that Lincoln says has reduced them to tears. That's the quality of his oratorial and writing skills. His last efforts in Congress are to outlaw slavery in Washington, D.C. That goes down in defeat. He actually makes an argument before the Supreme Court about a 20-year-old issue over a deed. He loses. And then he also applies for a patent to help ships get over the shoals. And he's still the only president that we have that applied for and received a patent for machinery.
Yeah, amazing. Well, let's take us to the Civil War. Of course, Abraham Lincoln gets elected, the new Republican Party. He was not a Republican at first, right? He was a
Now, he if,
committed Whig, and then he joins later on. Tell me about that.
He sees a lot of the Whigs moving into the Republican Party, but he's not sold because a good bit of the Republican Party is made up from the know-nothings, who, as I'm sure most of your listeners might recall from the 1850s, were, all American, like America first. And by America first, we mean no Irish, certainly no blacks, free blacks, or whichever. And they ran roughshod in Philadelphia. I have a family Bible from my grandmother's family, the McFetridges, from the 1840s. And the Bible just says Fetridge. They took the Mick off because if there was a Mick or an O, you could get in trouble. And it isn't until later in the 1850s when he joins the Republican Party. It's really the only act left if he wants to move forward. But as always with Lincoln, in a very subtle and a very unforceful way, he starts to mold the Republican Party into his own images. And that starts with the Lincoln-Douglas debates.
Another aside, you write in the book that Honest Abe, that appellation, was not ironic. People saw him as being unable, or he didn't lie, or didn't lie much, I guess.
He was I think ensorcelled by the truth. And did he lie or mislead in his political career? Of course he did. And but at the same time, at the groundspring of it was the reason for something that needed to be done and done honestly. Yeah, he did. He's tenacious. I love the story of Stephen Douglas doing a summer campaign in 1858 for the Senate. using on the Illinois Central Railroad, of which Lincoln was a corporate attorney. And the vice president of the Illinois Central gives Douglas his private car to travel Illinois with, a young fellow named George McClellan. And Lincoln is getting the nut, got the Republican nomination. How's this going to happen? So he gets on the train, not in the same car, but on these whistle stop tours, and makes a point in the crowd saying, hey, when Steve's done, I'm here, I'd like to tell you my side of things. He's stalking Stephen Douglas. I mean, it's like he's for a few weeks Glenn Close in Fatal Attraction. And finally, Douglas, who doesn't want to debate him, he's better known. Lincoln is known, but not so well known. And over dinner, they agree to the seven debates, but one of the conditions is Lincoln has to get off his damn train.
That's fascinating. Another little nugget. Mary Todd announced she would tell people the man I marry is going to be president of the United States. And for a while, a couple of decades there, it looked like maybe she'd married the wrong man. Then it came true.
Now, that's a good case. We don't give Mary Todd enough recognition for her talents and what she went through in her life. Her father was a successful businessman, but her mother died when she was six. Her stepmother would be a candidate for the Grimm Brothers or a Walt Disney movie. The Todd's children by his first wife don't count. And it shows Mary's resilience. She's at a young lady school and she masters French, which is all they're teaching. She masters the social arts. Her father is friends with the Clays. And when they came for dinner, she would sit at Henry Clay's knee to the point where the family called her the little Whig. She's extremely observant about the political situations of things. So when she comes to Springfield, Lincoln is attracted, and we all know the story about, right before the wedding date, he reneges and goes off on what really is a bender of depression. And one of her suitors is Stephen Douglas, and another one, a fellow named Trumbull, who becomes a senator. In fact, he gets the nomination over Lincoln back in 1856. But when Lincoln comes back and reproposes, she marries him and she, gets what she'd asked for. And aside to all this, Mr. Williams, if we've got time, doing the research for the earlier books, The Revolution, The Founding Fathers, I came away convinced that if the founding fathers in the Constitutional Convention had given the right to vote to women, the first Adams president would have been Abigail. The Madison president would have been Dolly. His opponent that he beats in the election, Clinton, makes the comment, he only had to run against me. I had to run against Madison and his wife. I'm not sure Mary Todd would have gotten to the presidency, but I think she would have been a really strong political force.
Interesting. One more thing before we'll go to break, come back and talk about Gettysburg, the battle. But you write that when this is later in the book, when Robert Lee resigned his commission in the U.S. Army, April of 1861, he had foreseen what the outcome of the Civil War would be. And then you're writing in the aftermath now in March of 1865, he was living it, of course, the surrender. Tell me a little bit about that he was very conflicted. He chose his state in the end.
He really was conflicted. In fact, he had a brother, Smith Lee, who was in the Navy, and they had a real heart-to-heart, like, where are we going to go? And he's really not sure until the last moment that where things are. And he comes to the conclusion, I'm paraphrasing the exact quote, but I cannot, or I will not draw my sword against my state. We tend to forget how much states' rights counted, back in the day, certainly in the South and to a larger extent still do. But he was really reluctant to do that. Scott thought he'd made the mistake of his life because Lincoln, on Scott's recommendation, wanted Lee to command the entire army, not just an army. He wanted him to be in charge of everything. And Lee passed that up. And I think he really did know that. But, there was to him an honor in remaining with Virginia and sticking by the Confederacy that, it's hard for us to comprehend, I think.
Let's take another break. We'll come back with more with Tim McGrath. The book is Three Roads to Gettysburg, and we'll have more following this. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Tim McGrath. His latest book's out now. It's called Three Roads to Gettysburg, Meade, Lee, Lincoln, and the Battle That Changed the War, the Speech That Changed the Nation. So let's start with Lincoln's selection of George Meade. This is, he famously went through a lot of generals, finally settled on Grant right in the end. But tell me about that selection. It was surprising, I think, just right before Gettysburg.
Yeah, it was surprising, Mr. Williams. In various armies, three different armies in Virginia, Lincoln had gone through McDowell, McClellan, Pope, McClellan again, Burnside, and most recently Hooker, who was completely outfought and outthought at Chancellorsville. And the Chancellorsville was such a disaster that Lincoln literally had his head in his hands and saying, my God, what will the country say? And but it's weeks later, not till June 28th, when Lee's army has already invaded the North, that when Hooker comes up with another, I guess I'll resign, Lincoln goes, great. And he sends a acquaintance of Meade's, Colonel Hardee, by train to Frederick, Maryland, where Meade is. He finds him at 4:30 in the morning and wakes him up. Meade thinks he's being arrested because he had gotten into an argument with Hooker when Hooker sent a report that all his generals supported his leaving Chancellorsville. Meade said, I said we should stay and fight. When he's told that Hardee's there to tell him he's been appointed the commander of the Army of the Potomac, he turns it down. He doesn't want to do it. And Hardee says, this isn't an offer. This is an order. It's your gig. And so he's got 3 days to come up with how to organize, what, who to trust, how to get things moving. And he really succeeds quite admirably, obviously.
So how did the battle end up at Gettysburg? Of course, Lee is pushing north, but I think that I don't know if they both chose that actual site or one or the other.
The Battle of Gettysburg was fought without the two commanding officers present, pretty much through the whole first day. Lee shows up late in the afternoon. Meade doesn't show up until very late at night. Both armies have their different corps and different towns and trying to get them all together. The battle really starts when General Harry Heath's forces come upon Gettysburg. Both armies have been through there already, just very quickly. But General John Buford's cavalry fight a delaying action on foot, not horseback. And then General John Reynolds arrives, who's a very good friend of Meade and a fellow Pennsylvanian. He'd already said he would not take the command of the Army of the Potomac because he saw too many political consequences. But Reynolds had been through Gettysburg a year before. I did not know this, for the governor of Pennsylvania, checking in case we're invaded, where's a good place to be? And he saw the ground at Gettysburg. There's a story or legend that Wellington was accosted about the Battle of Waterloo. Why are you fighting there? And he said, because I saw this field years ago and I kept it in my pocket. Well, Reynolds did the exact same thing with Gettysburg. Unfortunately, he's killed almost immediately upon his arrival. And when Meade learns this, he's still coming up from Maryland. He then sends Winfield Scott Hancock, another Pennsylvanian, whom Meade not only admires but trusts, and says, get up there and tell me what's going on. So, as the battle continues, if it had been a one-day battle, it probably would have been a Confederate victory. Lee comes up late in the afternoon and sees what's going on. He did not want this to happen. Meade did not want this to happen. But Lee says, okay, let's try to finish this off. And they can't, or they don't, depending on your viewpoint. But the Army of the Potomac is driven precisely to where Reynolds would have fought the battle had they chosen ground. And when Meade shows up, he looks at it and goes, yeah, this is where we're fighting.
So high ground, right? That lesson he had
Yeah,
learned.
sure is.
Yes.
Yep.
So just in general, there's the high water mark, right, for the South. Lee almost won, didn't.
Yeah.
What were, I guess, a couple of factors? Why did the North win and the South lose that battle?
Well, the North won because they had the high ground, but also because of the generals as from Meade on down, with the exception of one fellow, Dan Sickles, that knew what they had to do and did it. Lee, according to Longstreet, had said that we'll invade the North, but we will fight a defensive battle. We're going to be outnumbered. And Longstreet just believes that, we're wasting not just time, but men's lives. He was not for what was going on at all. And yet his corps almost breaches the Union lines on July 2nd. They come this close to breaking the line, and mostly thanks to Sickles. And so he's not a happy camper. And yet the disastrous charge, Pickett's charge, they still, for a brief second, breach the Union line at Cemetery Ridge and Cemetery Hill. For maybe 2 minutes, it looks like they're going to break through. Part of Lee's plan was sending Jeb Stuart, who was the prodigal son of the Gettysburg campaign, showing up a day or so late, riding around behind in a way to say, okay, we can come this way against the Union forces. And Stuart is stopped by the Union cavalry, and particularly a couple of desperate charges by a fellow named George Armstrong Custer. So it ends with a Union victory. And that's when the troubles begin for me, because he doesn't follow up the way everybody thinks he should. Well, not everybody, but the Meade naysayers and Lincoln think should have happened.
He was criticized right after that, right? For not pursuing Lee, not
He didn't
capturing,
pursue. Right. He waited for days. And then when he finally caught Lee in Williamsport, Maryland, he saw Lee ensconced in the same high ground. It would have been Gettysburg in reverse. And I wonder if Lincoln had gone to some of the battlefields after the battles in Virginia. But I often wonder if he'd taken the train to Gettysburg in July and not November, and seen the disastrous results of this battle. The land has been laid waste, houses are non-existent. Not just thousands of men on both sides, but thousands of horses are lying dead and rotting all over the place. I think he would have some kind of an idea why Meade said, my army isn't strong enough to come and fight.
Oh, interesting. We just have a couple minutes left. I want to get to the Gettysburg Address, this famous, 47 years ago. It can't have taken more than 5 minutes. Reading through the speech, but what an impact! So this is November, right?
Yeah, today, November 19th.
19th. Wow! And Lincoln is going there to. They're dedicating the cemetery for the soldiers. Just very briefly, we just have about a minute left. What was the impact of this speech at the time? Of course, it had a huge impact in the years since.
It had a bigger impact than legend has us. It was interrupted a few times by applause, but when he stopped and sat back down, one of the reporters across the aisle from him leaned over and go, is that it? And Lincoln said, yes, for the present. But it wins acclaim in the newspapers supporting the Northern cause immediately. There are some papers, including in Pennsylvania, support anti-war, that talk about this was just doggerel what he spoke. But as we know now, Lincoln took he used the phrase "all men are created equal" as like a North Star for his life, not just his career. And here in 270 words, whichever version you like, He welds all men are created equal with the new birth of freedom and has left each succeeding generation with the responsibility of living up to that.
You maybe the good place to end the conversation here at the very end of your book. You quote Dr. Barbara Fields in the Ken Burns documentary. The Civil War is still going on. It's still being fought. Regrettably, it can still be lost. It's you can take any of the headlines out of current newspapers to illustrate that.
I could not add anything more that would make that sentence better.
Well, good place to end the conversation. Fascinating the aftermath, right? The lives of these men after Gettysburg. You'll
Absolutely.
have to go to the book to read that and learn again about Dan Sickles. That was one of the most fascinating figures for me. You'll have to go to the book and learn about him, a real scalawag.
I'll tell you, you read him and you think about. We look at things and how they mirror times today. I'll leave it to your listeners and viewers to see who Dan Sickles might resemble.
Well, we'll leave it there. The book is Three Roads to Gettysburg, and the author is Tim McGrath, and he's been talking about that with us. Tim McGrath, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Williams. I wish you a happy Thanksgiving and the same to your listeners and viewers.
Okay, thank you. And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.
This is Wild About Utah.
Leaves have fallen and are falling. It's fall. Their beauty, crunchiness, and odors excite my senses. Consider the leaf, these lovely little solar collectors. How can any device imagined by the human brain collect light energy from the sun and convert it to food and oxygen while sequestering carbon? A tall order, even with AI. Yet the humble leaf does it all. By capturing photons of light and utilizing the photosynthetic process, magic occurs. In brief terms, the light excites electrons in the leaf chlorophyll, which move through the electron transport chain, producing needed energy to build glucose, or food, from carbon dioxide and water absorbed from the Earth's atmosphere. The glucose molecules, along with phosphates, nitrates, and other chemicals, are used to build infinite numbers of other molecules essentially for life to occur. Hope that was brief enough. Yes, I have fallen in love with the leaves, from waving grasses to majestic tree leaves. While raking leaves in my yard, I'm smitten by their beauty and functionality and hope not to strain my back. Leaves from our Fremont cottonwood tree offer pyramids of gold with undulating leaf margins. Exquisite. One can easily make a teepee from them, or other possibilities depending on where your imagination takes you. Our aspen trees sprinkle gold coins in between. Aspen leaves have a special designed petiole, or leaf stem. Rather than the usual round shape, it is flattened, which allows it to flip upside down when struck by wind. This makes it doubly efficient at capturing sunlight, with both top and bottom of the leaf receiving light. Chlorophyll is also found in the bark, hidden behind the white dust covering. Wet the bark and the green chlorophyll becomes visible. We have many conifers in our yard, whose specialized leaves in the form of needles perform the same function. Their tiny surface area and wax-like coating are excellent adaptations for reducing transpiration, that is, plant evaporation. This allows them to maintain their leaves through the extreme drought of winter's cold temperatures and frozen ground, whereas broadleaf trees would soon dehydrate if their leaves were not to drop. We have many other broadleaf trees on our landscape: box elder, green ash, Rocky Mountain maple, cherry, and river birch. Thus, we are blessed with a myriad of leaf shapes, colors, and textures. I enjoy all varieties, an artist's delight. One we're missing is gamble oak, which was abundant in our North Ogden backyard. These are a subspecies of eastern white oak, as the Rocky Mountain bigtooth maple is a subspecies of the eastern sugar maple. Utilitarian uses of leaves add more to the enjoyment. Excellent mulch, compost, and piles for the grandkids to frisk in. Leaving some of them on the lawn in a shredded, that is, mowed condition is good nourishment for the grasses. A healthy medium-sized maple tree has around 100,000 leaves. That's a lot of solar collectors. How many blades of grass in the average lawn? I leave that one up to you, dear listener. This is Jack Green for Bridgeland Audubon Society, and I'm wild about every leaf I know, even poison ivy.
This is Ag Matters.
Climate change is impacting agriculture, but researchers at Utah State University are working on a groundbreaking solution. Beneficial microbes. Just as we have helpful bacteria in our bodies, plants also rely on microbes for growth and drought resistance. Plant scientists are exploring how to harness these tiny organisms to make crops more resilient. They are investigating if it's possible to take growth-promoting bacteria from certain plants and incorporate them into others. The result could be reducing the need for chemical fertilizers, which can harm soil health. Collaborating with farmers, USU researchers work to make crops stronger, soil healthier, and farming practices more sustainable.
This has been Ag Matters from the Quinney College of Agriculture and Natural Resources at Utah State University.